From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The reporter Russell Gold says the old order of energy in this country is tumbling. The reign of coal, he says, is tenuous. Even petroleum's stranglehold is weakening. Natural gas is on the rise, a vast, untapped energy source literally under our feet. And Gold says the technology used to get at it, fracking, is transforming the United States. In his new book, Gold explores how this once obscure oil field technique has come to define the country's economic and environmental future. Today on the program, he's joining us to talk about fracking, tell the story of it, in fact, and to work through the fact and fiction in the story. His book is called The Boom. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. You can donate $10 right now by texting KUER to 85944. That's KUER to 85944. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Russell Gold's new book begins in a surprisingly personal way. Gold is an energy reporter, an acclaimed, respected national investigative reporter, and he begins his new book about natural gas fracking with the predicament of his own parents. His folks own some land in north-central Pennsylvania, and they were offered a sizable chunk of money if they would allow a natural gas company to drill on it, to use hydraulic fracking to unlock the fuel embedded deep in the rock below. And Gold says in his book that when his mother called and asked should they sign the lease, he knew how complex a question it was. In the book, Gold says there are no easy answers to the energy puzzle in this country or around the world for that matter. There are unforeseen costs, necessary evils. He explores in the book what he calls the promise and peril of fracking. He says the traditional energy system is being torn down and rebuilt, and the book is an opportunity to take a hard look at the energy we all use. We're talking about the book today, and we invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. The book is called The Boom, How Fracking Ignited the American Energy Revolution and Changed the World. Russell Gold, an investigative reporter for The Wall Street Journal, joining us from the studios of NPR in New York City. And Russell Gold, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
I wanted to start. Let's start with the personal part of this. This is not a memoir, but it is a way into the story. And I wanted to talk about the offer made to your parents. It came from a company called Chesapeake Energy. And explain your parents, because I think it's what's interesting about this part of the story is that it kind of underscores the conflict that they must have really felt about the offer, that you described them as, I don't know if lefties is the way to put it, but they were certainly immersed in left-wing anti-war politics.
No, absolutely. Definitely left-wing and continuing to this day. This was land that they had bought in the early 70s. It's sort of set amidst what then were dairy farms, and this was the poor parcel of land that was rocky and hilly, and dairy farmers couldn't use it. So it didn't have a use by any of the people locally, and it was for sale. So my parents with some friends bought it, and it was going to be a place for cheap vacations, a way to get away and introduce their city kids to some of the pleasures of nature. Mm. We've owned it for years.
Yeah.
And then about 2008, I get this call. And it actually took me by surprise because at that point, fracking was spreading faster than even I realized. Mm. I had been reporting on it since 2003.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize it had gone that far. And suddenly, I was sort of taken out of my comfort zone as a reporter and being asked a very personal question. Should we do this? Should we allow it?
It's interesting that you chose to sort of begin with that. And I guess on some level, maybe it's a way of disclosure. But you've also talked about how the personal aspect of it gave you, let's see, this is how you put it. You said you were able to see these issues in finer detail than maybe you were before.
Yeah. Well, and it also, the question that was being posed to me, should we do this? Should we embrace fracking? on the acres that my parents owned was really the question that the entire United States and ultimately the world is going to be facing. Should we embrace fracking? And if we do, how should we do it? And those really are the questions that we're all facing right now. And we as a country are facing, and many individuals who own land are facing. And it's a really important question, because if we get this wrong, we're going to look back on this energy boom with incredible regret. I live in Texas right now, and there's this famous bumper sticker that was said to have appeared in the mid-'80s in places like Midland and Houston, places that went through the last big energy boom. And it said something like, "Dear Lord, please send me one more energy boom, and I promise not to mess it up this time."
Right.
Well, we have another boom. Yeah. We are going through an unbelievable energy boom in the United States thanks to this new technology, fracking. And the question is, how do we avoid messing it up this time?
Put that in perspective, though, because it's not just a boom. I mean, it's a revolution. How significant
right.
is this? Because you say it's really transforming. It's changed the story.
Well, let me take a couple steps back in time and explain exactly where all this oil and gas that we use every day when we go to the gas station or when we turn on our stoves at home or when we flip on the lights, because so much of American electricity comes from natural gas. It comes from, generally speaking, these shale rocks, because shale rocks are the kitchen. They are the source rocks. This is where millions of years ago tiny zooplankton and other microscopic organisms died, and mud came over them, and they were cooked with heat and pressure over millions of years and turned into what we now call crude oil and natural gas. And the reason this is so fantastic in terms of just the technological change is that for years we have been drilling in this country and around the world looking for places where oil and gas that escaped from that rock has traveled up and has pooled underground. Now we're going to that rock itself, and there was no way to open this rock up. We knew there was oil and gas there, but if you as a petroleum engineer drilled into a shale rock, you might get fired because there was no way to do anything with it. The well wouldn't flow.
Yeah.
And the technological change was figuring out a way to crack open the rock, to fracture, which is what fracking really means, so that oil and gas flows from it.
You mentioned in your book that how you've been covering energy for a long time now, really mm-hmm. even before fracking was the story that it was. I mean, you were covering
yeah.
what they called the independence before all of this. Were
mm-hmm.
you surprised when it – because it seems to have just caught hold.
No, absolutely. I mean, I remember back in 2003, I got a call from this company out of Oklahoma City, Devon Energy, and they said, "Well, we're doing this new thing outside of Fort Worth, and we're trying to convince Wall Street and others that there's value here, that there's really gas. Come on out and take a look at it." And that was the Barnett Shale, the first shale
yeah.
that was developed just north of Fort Worth, and actually inside Fort Worth eventually also. You know, at the time, it's hard to describe, but even back then, we didn't have the terminology for it. People weren't even calling it fracking. Nobody understood exactly the potential of this. In fact, Devon, which develops the first shale field, they would write to their investors that this field is unique. They use that word, unique. And as it turns out, not at all, because after the Barnett came the Haynesville and the Fayetteville and the Marcellus and the Eagleford and the Bakken. And on and on and on. It turns out there's shales everywhere in the United States, in Canada, and now we're starting to explore them around the world as well. So, no, we had no idea how big this was. I didn't as a reporter. The industry didn't either.
I want to talk about the history of fracking because you deal with mm-hmm. this in the book, which seems to be in some ways a significant part of the controversy, this dispute about just how old fracking is. Say something a little bit about the dispute.
It's hugely controversial because yeah. people who are opposed to fracking, the fractivists as they call themselves, they will claim that this is a new technology, it's untested, and it's dangerous. And the industry will come back and say, "Oh, no, we've been fracking for 50 years. We know what we're doing. You can trust us. This isn't new. You shouldn't be alarmed." I actually think they're both wrong in a way.
Yeah.
I trace fracking all the way back to the 1860s, to the very birth of the oil industry in western Pennsylvania. And it was sort of a fascinating story because the father of the oil industry is a man named Edwin Drake, Colonel Drake, they called him. He went out to Pennsylvania and introduced himself as a colonel, even though he wasn't. And like many wildcatters of the day, he would drill a well, and if he found oil, he could become fabulously wealthy. And if he drilled a couple wells that didn't work, he could become penniless. And Colonel Drake ended up pretty much living on the streets of New York, penniless later in life. But into that same environment came another gentleman named Colonel Roberts. He actually was a colonel in the Civil War. And he had invented basically a small bomb that you put down at the bottom of a well, a torpedo. You ignite it, and it would send out fractures into the rock. And the genius of it was that you could drill a well, which is only a few inches across, and come just tantalizingly close to an oil seam, but the well was dry. But if you put the torpedo down there and exploded it, you would send out fractures, fingers around the well, and tap into oil seams. And it was the most popular invention of its time. Everyone, you absolutely had to use a torpedo once you drilled your well. Colonel Roberts died one of the wealthiest men in the United States. So that sort of gives you a sense of just even from the beginning how popular it was to bend rock, to smash rock, to do more than just drill a well into the rock. And so really from the beginning of the oil industry, you have this urge, this financial motivation really to smash and to fracture rocks. But then it's forgotten for decades because you start finding these giant gushers. And you don't need to fracture anything because, frankly, the oil's coming up so quickly. I mean, think James Dean in Giant or, you know, one of the Hollywood pictures of the oil just gushing up. Even the early scenes of There Will Be Blood more recently have some of that. And so you didn't need to fracture it. But then those giant gushers in the industry are called elephants. And by not long after World War II, the elephants have been hunted pretty much to extinction in the United States. And the industry goes back to this old technology and starts asking themselves, can we fracture the rocks and get more out of it? And so from just after World War II on, there is this early hydrofracking is what they call it. And it's incredibly widely used. Thousands, tens of thousands of wells. And so in that sense, the industry is right. We have been using water to fracture wells since just after World War II. But something happens in the late 90s which really changes this technology.
It's water, right?
It's water. And it's more than just water. It's supersizing it.
Yeah.
I talked to the engineer who did the first modern frack in 1998, and he remembers just the amount of pumps and water he had assembled there to try this. And workers from all around were coming by and just looking at it, thinking to themselves, what is going on this one well? Because this doesn't look like any setup we've ever done before. He used many times more water and much more pressure. And it was a very simple question. Can water under incredible pressure crack this incredibly dense rock? And as it turns out, the answer was yes.
Yeah.
And so when fractivists, people who are opposed to fracking, say, well, this is a new, untested technology, they're right in one sense, and that is that the world's oldest modern shale well that's been fracked is now only 16 years old. It's incredibly young, and so we are still learning, both in terms of how to get more oil and gas out of the ground, but how to do it in an appropriate, environmentally safe manner.
I want to say about the book, you mentioned Colonel Roberts. This is Edward. I have to say, a great character. I mean, he was a tinkerer.
He invented something for dental offices.
Dental offices, right.
Dentures.
Right.
In the office. You no longer had to send out to get your dentures set in India. What was it called? In plastic. You could do it in the office. And make quite a bit of money from it.
Yeah. Well, the point is, I think, is that it's full of these amazing characters like Edward Roberts. And it. I think we need to talk about George Mitchell.
Yes.
Because he is really central to this story. He is, as you describe him, an unusual Texas oil man, son of an illiterate Greek shepherd, goat herd.
Mm-hmm. Goat herder.
Yeah, goat herder. And he... talk a little bit about him, because he has this hunch in the 1950s, I think it was.
A couple minutes ago I started talking about just after World War II, there's a shift in the industry. And the big wildcatting, the well, you know, these giant wells of yore start to go away. And the industry starts getting a little more serious you know, moving away from this past where you just drill the well on a hunch and adopting more science and trying to really understand what was going on. And George Mitchell's right in the middle of that. He comes out of Texas A&M University just after World War II, early 50s. And he is really part of the group of people who takes the oil and gas industry and drags it into a more modern science-oriented way. And he would sit around at night. He must have had an amazing constitution because he would work all day, and then after all of his all of his fellow wildcatters would go home, he would go and he would study log data. Mm-hmm. So a new well would be drilled, and he would look to figure out, okay, where is the rock and what type of rocks and how deep did one rock change into another? And he thought he saw what's called a stratigraphic trap, a trap where oil and gas would migrate upwards but then hit this ceiling underground and pool there. And that's exactly where you wanted to drill. And he thought he saw that. And so he wanted to drill some wells in north of Fort Worth. And right about the same time, believe it or not, there's a bookie making the rounds in Houston saying, I've got this deal I want someone to cut in on. And the deal was for several thousand acres exactly where George Mitchell had seen what he thought was a trap that would have natural gas. And so they make a deal, and George Mitchell quietly goes up there and drills a well. And believe it or not, he uses fracking. Not the modern fracking, but he uses this old fracking because other companies had been there and drilled wells without fracking, hadn't worked at all. He goes in there, and he breaks up the rock a little, and he makes a good well. In fact, his first 10 wells are all good wells. Yeah. And as quietly as he can, he leases every acre he can grab. So he builds himself a very successful company. And what's fascinating about him is that he becomes very, very wealthy. Like you said, he grew up very poor in Galveston, Texas, becomes very wealthy, and his mind starts to wander. He loses a little interest in the oil and gas business. And believe it or not, he becomes very interested in sustainability.
Yeah.
He meets Buckminster Fuller in Aspen and sort of falls under the sway of Buckminster Fuller and this belief that, look, we live on spaceship Earth, and what can we do to sustain spaceship Earth. He endows, he's one of the original people who endows sustainability studies at the National Academy of Sciences, just does all this interesting work. But at the same time, he's making his money off of a non-renewable resource, drilling for gas.
Yeah.
He's just a fascinating character and very liberal, too. Not what you expect from a Houston oil man.
No, you describe him as a jumble of contradictions. And what's interesting about it, you mentioned, so he's spending all of this time paying attention. I mean, he creates this new type of green city outside of Houston.
Right. Sure, the Woodlands.
The Woodlands. But you say he never really did try to make his own company, Mitchell Engineer Energy, a green company.
No. He never was interested in solar or wind. And when I asked him why, he died last year, but I was able to interview him before he passed away. He just sort of, he looked at me and he said, because it just didn't make financial sense. He was an engineer. He wasn't a dreamer. He didn't want to do something that he thought didn't make sense. But what's interesting is that while he didn't want to take a gamble on wind or solar, from 1982 on, he did gamble on something else. And that was spending millions of dollars drilling a few wells a year into this super dense rock, the Barnett Shale, and trying to figure out, how do we make this work? How can I make a good well from it, a well that will, the oil and gas will come out. It's mostly gas there. The gas will come out of. And he told his engineers, he said, look, there is no failure. The only failure is not doing it. We are going to do this, and we're going to fail, and we're going to make bad wells. We will learn from it. We'll use science. We'll study it, and we'll get better, and we'll do this. And what's amazing in terms of talk about persistence, for 16 years he does this, and not a single good well comes out of it. But he keeps drilling, and each year there's a budget to try to explore the Barnett Shale. And it's not until 1998 that he cracks the code.
Is it fair to say, is it too overwrought to say it was kind of a eureka moment when they crack it?
You know, it was a little bit of a eureka moment. I spent a day with the engineer who actually did it, and he was cautiously positive because he had gotten permission to try this new form of fracking. He was trying this for three wells, and he messed up all three. Too much sand clogged up the well, et cetera. He couldn't get the water in that he wanted to. So he went back to get permission and do three more, and the fourth was also a failure. It sanded out. And it was on the fifth well that he was able to push all the water down that he wanted to. And he goes back to his office and goes into his boss's office, and he's just he was not prone to outbursts of emotion. And he said, I think I did it. It swallowed all the water. And then they just had to wait and see, because then you had to bring the water back and to see if gas would flow out of it. But when it flowed out of it, it was by far and away the best well that they had ever drilled into the Barnett. Put everything else to shame. And they knew from that point on that they had something.
Let's talk about one of the another one of the important elements of the book, which is mm-hmm. this relationship between drillers and homeowners. It's an important part of the story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And let's say this. I mean, when you were talking about the boom, the title of your book, one of the things that is different about the shale boom from the oil boom is the proximity to people's lives. This is really close. And this is an important part of the story. Talk about that.
No, absolutely. I mean, this is... You know, the last time we had a big oil boom, it was north of the Arctic Circle in Alaska. And we've had oil booms way out in the Gulf of Mexico. This oil boom is taking place in people's backyards, very literally. The first shale is literally in the suburbs of Fort Worth and spreads through Fort Worth and down south. You know, next door to Utah right now, outside of Denver, we have a lot of drilling and fracking going on the Niobrara Shale. Places like Broomfield and Boulder and even up into Fort Collins are holding referendums, discussing it, trying to figure out what to do. Last year, a colleague and I plotted out all of the wells in the United States and found all of the wells that have been drilled in the last 10 years or so since the shale boom began and asked how many people live near it. And the answer we came up with was 15 million people live within a mile of a new well that had been drilled. It's more than live in New York City or Michigan. And what's amazing or what's fascinating about this is that many of those people own the rights, the mineral rights mm-hmm. to the land. And what that means is that if you own the mineral rights, then if a company wants to come and drill, they have to negotiate with you. They have to make a bonus payment to you or a leasing payment, and then they have to share the royalties. And that's, in fact, what happened with my parents and their land is right. that there was a financial negotiation. But sometimes you have a situation where somebody sold off the mineral rights. They kept the land, and they sold off the mineral rights. And as the shale boom starts, no one really thought about that too much. When you were buying a house in the Fort Worth suburbs in 2003, 2004, you didn't stop to think, well, do I own the mineral rights to my quarter acre
yeah.
or eighth of an acre? And the reason that became such a critical question was because if you didn't own those mineral rights— an oil and gas company could come and drill under your house, near your house, and you didn't have a choice because the mineral rights under law are considered the dominant estate. They are more important than the surface estate. That's an old part of law that goes back 100 years in the United States and even longer in places like England where we adopted the law from. And so it becomes this really very interesting dynamic where – in my travels in Pennsylvania and North Dakota and elsewhere, many of the people I met and talked with who had the mineral rights would say, you know what, we appreciate getting this money. This is something that is good for us and good for our communities. It's the people who didn't have the mineral rights, who had to put up with all of the downside of fracking and drilling and this industrial development without getting any benefit, any money from it. That's really where you started hearing these incredibly loud complaints and fears about fracking emerging.
There are these two stories that you tell when you talk about kind of the legal framework through the story. There's one that involves a man named Otis Grimes.
Yes, Otis Grimes.
Yeah, he buys a house for his family in Burke Burnett, Wait. Texas. Is that it?
Oh, well, very well, good pronunciation.
Yeah, good.
most people mess that up. Yes, yeah, it's Burke Burnett.
Burke Burnett, yeah. Well,
he goes out.
You tell the story because I want to contrast this with Emily Krafcek.
Krafcek, yeah.
Krafcek, yeah.
Well, so Otis Grimes and his family, they go to Burke Burnett. And for any of your listeners who might remember the movie Boomtown from many, many years ago, that's set in Burke Burnett. It was a classic oil boom, tiny little sleepy town transformed overnight. And he buys a house, which must have been difficult because at the time there was almost no place to live. Stories about people camping out on porches and whatnot. He buys a house and he sets it up. He's living there with his wife and his kids. And he works in the oil and gas business. He's a driller. And an oil derrick is erected literally right next to his house. Some of the guidelines to keep it steady are going right past his house. They put an engine, a motor, so close to his house he can't even talk to his wife. And so it gets so fed up that he brings a lawsuit to basically say, you have ruined my domestic bliss. I cannot live in my own house anymore, and this is not fair. And what's amazing is that as it goes through the courts in Texas essentially say, and this was a 1919 case, but the courts in Texas say, look, we're sorry. The mineral rights and developing this mineral wealth is so important. You should have known. And you know, this is not a legal terminology, but essentially what it came down to is tough luck.
Tough luck, yeah.
But that balancing act that the courts and politicians, they see so much benefit in encouraging oil and gas development that sometimes, and we've seen this again now in this most recent fracking boom, there are some people who end up being put out, the Otis Grimes of the world. And so, and you bring up Emily Kraftjack because I found her to be a fascinating character, and I met many people like Emily over the years. She lives in Pennsylvania right now, not very far from where my parents live, near Mehoopany, Pennsylvania. And she, a drilling rig went up not 400 or 500 feet from her. And it was that she said that the trucks lining up to deliver sand or to deliver water to that frack site would go right past her house and would be idling, and the diesel fumes would give her a headache and she couldn't hear. But what I found fascinating about Emily is that she didn't do what Otis did. She didn't sue. She knew she didn't have the rights to do that. She organized.
Yeah.
She got together with her neighbors and started making phone calls and learning more about this and talking with her local leaders. And she was able to get some very common sense safeguards built in that trucks did not idle outside her house. That the trucks had to gather somewhere nearby, not close to where anyone was living, and turn off their engines so they weren't having diesel fumes. And they built a sound wall around the house so she could sleep at night. Was it perfect? Absolutely not. But she really represents, I think, a real vanguard of people out there in the country who are saying, we understand fracking's going to happen. We see some of the benefits. Emily told me herself, look, some of my neighbors have been unemployed for years and were able to get good paying jobs. I appreciate that. But I'm not just going to let industry come and do whatever it wants. I'm going to hold them to account and hold them to the highest standard. And so in some ways, that's sort of the bookends. Yeah. Otis Grimes gets run over by the oil industry. This time, the law's a little bit more on the side of homeowners. And you know, with organizing and with really focusing and holding industry to account, she was able to get her life back, to get her house back, and you know, to a way I think that she was, if not thrilled about it, at least happy about it.
Russell Gold is with us. His book is called The Boom: How Fracking Ignited the American Energy Revolution and Changed the World. We need to take a brief break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Every day, 100 new oil and gas wells are drilled or hydraulically fractured in America. And this recent fracking boom has produced immense amounts of energy, a lot of money, and a whole lot of controversy as well. In a new book called The Boom, Wall Street Journal reporter Russell Gold is trying to cut through all of the noise from both sides to understand just how we can best get the energy we rely on every day. The book is called The Boom: How Fracking Ignited the American Energy Revolution and Changed the World. He's joining us from the studios of NPR New York City. So one of the things that you were up against, and I'm sure you knew this having covered it as you did, just how polarized the dialogue is, how polarized this question is. And what you've talked about is the stuff that you were hearing and reporting from both sides of all of this didn't really reflect a kind of reality that you saw. Give us a sense of what you mean by that.
Well, I could sit there at my desk in Texas and read my emails and talk to spokespeople and environmental groups coming in, you know, calling me on the phone. And then when I got out on the road and would travel, as I often did, into these communities that were at the heart of some of these booms, I would hear something very different, just a different conversation. You know, what I would hear at my desk was either, you know, how horrible this was and how it was going to destroy the water or destroy the air. And then I would hear, no, it's fine and we're creating millions of jobs. But what I heard from people out who were living through this was something different. And what – let me give you one example. The number one complaint I heard from people who lived in these new fracking areas was trucks. They did not like the trucks. They were being overrun by trucks. These quiet roads that they used to drive on were suddenly full of trucks, and the trucks were tearing up the roads, and they had potholes and bumps. And it was just a different conversation that was going on out there. And then I would say, okay, well, you know, the only way to stop these trucks is to stop the development. No, we don't want to do that. You know, my neighbor's kid and my grandson just got this great job, and look at all this you know, this economic development going on. They're building a new hotel in the nearby county seat. It was just a different conversation, and I needed to try to square that because, these are really tough and important questions that we're facing right now. You talked about how, you know, the energy industry is crumbling. It's changing. This is an energy revolution. There's no question about it. But it's a revolution in sort of the sense of the word that it's a circle. That we don't know where this circle ends up. We don't know where this change is taking us. But we really do need to stay quite focused and engaged.
Well, this is an important part of the book because you start to talk about how we're at this – seems like we're at this kind of transformational moment where we can decide or at least have a powerful influence on how this is all going to end up. You tell the story about you're talking with your family. Your mom calls you. I'm sure your dad calls you too. And they're like, what should we do? Should we sign this lease? What do you think we should do? It looks like it's going to happen. There's no stopping it. And one of the things you said to your mother one day was that, look, you've got the leverage now. So what you should be doing is you should be using this land as leverage to write these agreements that gives you some say over where the drills should go. I mean, you talk about how Ted Turner had done this. And this seems like one of the things that's an important point to say. There's a middle ground, or there's a way to work through all of this.
Well, let me tell you sort of a two sides of that story. I absolutely gave that advice to my parents, and they negotiated to make sure that the frack pad was on the far side of their property, really very close to the property line, so it didn't impact what they loved about going up to the land, which was peace and quiet. And I should say, once the well is drilled, it's quiet. There's an active well does not make noise. But the downside, I sort of stumbled upon the downside of that not much later when I started covering a story out of Denver, Colorado, where a local congressman, the Boulder congressman, Jared Polis, got a call one day from, I believe it was his in-laws, who were staying at this house he owned in the country near Boulder. And they had set up a rig right at the end of his driveway, right across the property line. So on the one hand, you are in control and you want to negotiate to get the rig and to get the disturbance as far from you as possible. But sometimes you can end up putting that right into your neighbor's lap as well. It's difficult.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because you write about one of the things you deal with, of course, in the book are the myths, the fiction of this story and the reality and the truth. And I wanted to go through a couple of these. One of the things that comes up is one of the myths that you've talked about is that you can either see this, you have to be either pro-fossil fuel or you have to be pro-renewable energy. And you say that's kind of a false comparison. That's not really true.
It's not really true. And frankly, it's destructive to think that way. We either have to be drill, baby, drill or go 100% renewables. The truth of the matter is that energy is an incredibly complex system, and delivering energy so that every time you turn on the lights and every time you pull up to a gas station, there's gas for you and there's juice to put the lights on is incredibly complicated, and we cannot just snap our fingers and say, okay, we're going to go fully renewable tomorrow. It just doesn't work that way. The major big hurdle is that the power grid is not designed for that. We live with a power grid that's has been set up to have these centralized power plants to distribute power to people. Well, we can't just suddenly turn around and say, well, we're going to use that power grid now and everyone's going to have solar panels on their roofs and maybe a little bit of backup power. But the real point I want to make is that we live in a world right now where renewable energy, putting hydro and dams to the side, makes up just a tiny portion of our power that we use in this country. And we use enormous amounts of power, the United States. So what we should be asking ourselves is, how do we get to 10%? How do we get to 20%, 30%? If that's really where we want to go, and I think there's broad agreement that a low-carbon energy future is where we want to go. And one of the points I make is that if you want to begin envisioning that, you need a lot of natural gas to back it up, because you need something that can be ready to jump in there when the wind stops blowing unexpectedly, or clouds go in front of the sun and all of a sudden people who rely on solar need to pull energy from the grid. And natural gas is incredibly well suited for that.
Well, you mentioned Germany, for example, which they went all in terms of renewables. But you talk about how their emissions have gone up because they don't have the right system to back it up.
Well, not just that. Their emissions have gone up because they've had to rely more on coal. But just this morning, the German parliament voted to roll a little bit of this back because the sticker shock has been so high that, yes, they've done a lot of renewables, but the price tag went so high up that industry is beginning talking about moving jobs out of the country and residents are unhappy. We in the United States have introduced an enormous amount of renewable energy over the last 5-10 years. States have adopted these renewable portfolio standards, these targets that they want to get to. And there hasn't been any sticker shock. There hasn't been a single state, once they introduced these renewable targets, that's pulled them back. And one of the reasons is because we have had so much natural gas, such an abundance of natural gas, that our power prices have gone down. And I think one of the points I want to make in this book is that if we want to have a massive change to energy in our energy system, it's always better to do it in a time of abundance of energy, as counterintuitive as that sounds, versus a time of scarcity. Because in a time of scarcity, you make decisions on the fly and it's chaotic and prices are going up. Well, we have an abundance of energy right now. Now is the time to do it, so that in 2030, when this energy boom peters out, if not sooner, we have something, we've built something that is mature and ready to take over. And I know it's very difficult to accept that we might be talking about 20, 30 years in the future, because we want to do something. So many people want to do something right now about climate change and to eliminate emissions, carbon dioxide, methane emissions into the atmosphere. And I think they're absolutely right to do that. But we cannot simply wish it to be. We have to build an energy system that gets us there. And we're realistically talking about years into the future and incremental changes to get there.
Do you think maybe it's an overly simple question to say, is fracking right now a net gain or net loss? When you take into account the realities of the technology, wastewater, when you're talking about all of the chemicals, and again, you say a lot of this, we don't exactly know what the effect of this is going to be. Yeah. You know, the question of whether wastewater, in fact, does cause earthquakes, the effect on aquifers, all of these kinds of questions. I mean, those are still up in the air. You address them in the book, talk about all those kinds of questions. But, you know, is it a net gain or a net loss in the scheme of things?
No, it's a very important and great question. Absolutely. We have to stay on top of the environmental studies to understand air emissions and water emissions. And many very interesting things are being done to lower the risk and to lower emissions. But to answer your question, I'm sitting here in New York City right now. The air in New York City is cleaner than it's been in years for one very simple reason. Coal plants nearby have been closed down and replaced with natural gas plants, a much cleaner fuel. And this is just one example of how I think this is a net gain. Natural gas is a very clean, efficient fuel, much better than what it's replacing, which is coal. And so while there are numerous risks that can be managed for the most part with smart regulation, I think it's a net benefit. It has been a net benefit so far. The real question is, we can slip backwards. We can lose some of those gains if there's not the right regulatory framework and the right – just making sure that everyone is constantly pursuing moving towards perfection. We'll never get to perfect, but if we keep moving towards perfection, keep asking ourselves, how do we make sure that that well is built right so that nothing leaks into the aquifer? How do we capture some of the emissions so that some of the BTEC, some of these chemical emissions do not come off there are not too many of them wafting off the compressors and other facilities that are used in fracking. We need to constantly be asking that question and pushing towards that, because if we do, I think we'll be able to sustain this momentum and we'll look back with relief that we embrace this instead of regret.
You write about in that vein, you write about insisting on better testing. You say we need to deal with the methane leakage, which is a real problem with fracking. It hasn't been resolved yet. Hasn't really been figured out yet. Making sure the wells are built properly. And this is another thing you say in terms of regulation, which you referred to. You say the watchdog that's looking out over all of this stuff can't be under the same roof as the cheerleader for the industry.
It happens so often around the country. The federal government only 2 or 3 years ago, after the Deepwater Horizon spill, changed that. We still see that in state after state, where the agency that's charged with promoting oil and gas development is the same agency which is charged with regulating it. You have to split those up. I've never seen one example of a state agency that did it right when it was all under the same roof. And we have to do better with methane leakage. Natural gas is methane, basically, and it's a very potent greenhouse gas. And if we're losing it into the atmosphere instead of moving it down the pipes to be burned, that's a big problem. But the good news is all the studies, and there have been numerous studies and they continue coming out, basically show it is a net benefit for the environment right now using natural gas. And there's a lot of low-hanging fruit to make it better, so we can make it considerably better. We need to stay on that, and certainly seems like that's the direction that we're heading right now. And we also absolutely need to do testing. Before every well is drilled, why not test the air and the water? Have a baseline so that if something goes wrong, we know it. Too often what's happened in places like Pennsylvania is that something has gone wrong. Mm-hmm. An aquifer has suddenly gotten some methane in it, which has caused some wells to go bad. And there are arguments over who caused the fault and was it natural, was it the company or this or that, because no one had bothered to test the water beforehand. And so the benefit of that is that we'll be able to hold accountable companies that should be held accountable, and we'll also get a database of what our environment looks like. 100 wells a day. If we do this for 100 wells a day, we'll start building this wonderful database of the water in our ground and the quality of our air, and we'll be able to ask and answer much better questions about what is the environment that we live in.
There's this story you tell in the book about your parents when they had first purchased the land and they were trying to build this simple house. They were all trying to – they didn't, you know, these were Philadelphia folks. They were city folks. They didn't know what they were doing. Your dad tried to do the electrical, and he kind of blew it.
Because he had taken electrical shop in seventh grade.
Right,
and told me that's why he did the electrical.
Exactly. And he does it wrong. He does the boxes. He gets the wrong size. And an inspector comes out and says, sorry, I'm not gonna do that. And he tries to – like a Philadelphia guy would, right? Like a city guy.
Right.
Tries to sort of bribe him or give him a little bit
of
money.
Well, he thought he was asking for a bribe, basically.
Yeah.
This was just sort of a setup. And
yeah.
It turned out it was the exact opposite, because when he – and one of my great regrets in this book is that I tried everything I could to track this inspector down and was not able to find him. But my father trots out after him, and you know that some of the people who own the land had their kids playing around nearby, and I was one of them. I was probably 1 or 2 years old at the time this story takes place. And my father is trying to do the lead up to say, well, you know, would $50 help, something of that nature. And the inspector, before he was able to get it out of his mouth, understood what he was getting at. And he turns to him, he says, look, you see those kids over there? If I were to approve this and anything were to happen with them, I could never live with myself. And I listened to that story and I thought to myself, well, that's really what we're all going through right now. We're building a new energy system. And so we need to do it in a way that we can look back and say, I can live with myself. We did this right. We didn't lose this opportunity. we didn't miss this opportunity. And that's I include that story right at the beginning because I think we all should take a page from what the inspector said. Say, yeah, money is important, but doing things right is even more important.
Russell Gold. His book is called The Boom, How Fracking Ignited the American Energy Revolution and Changed the World. Joined us from the studios of NPR in New York City. Russell Gold, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you, Doug.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.